Hello, and welcome to today's webinar, Building Competencies for Careers, preparing students for 21st century jobs. I'm Jason Amos, Vice President of Communications at the Alliance for Excellent Education. We're pleased to have you join us today. Seated to my right is Maria Ferguson. Maria is the Executive Director of the Center on Education Policy, or CEP, at the George Washington University in Washington, D.C. CEP is a trusted nonpartisan source for education research and analysis for policymakers, educators, and the public. Prior to joining CEP, Maria was actually a colleague of mine here at the Alliance, where she was Vice President for Policy. In addition to roles with the National School Boards Foundation and with New American Schools, she worked as Director of Communication and Outreach Services for the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Elementary and Secondary Education during the Clinton administration. Maria, it's great to have you back in the Alliance's office.
Very glad to be here.
Next to Maria is Air Force Major General Mike Hall. General Hall retired from the U.S. Air Force in 1995 after a distinguished career as a fighter pilot that spanned nearly three decades, beginning with the F-106 and ending with the F-16. He's currently president of PFA Consulting, a leadership services firm based in Ithaca, New York, and is president and CEO of the Wings of Eagles Discovery Center in Horseheads, New York. We'll learn more about the Wings of Eagles Discovery Center later in this webinar. General Hall is also a member of Mission Readiness, the organization of more than 700 retired admirals and generals, strengthening national security by ensuring kids stay in school, stay fit, and stay out of trouble. Next to General Hall, Sam Whiting, Director of Global Engagement for the Western Region of the Boeing Company. In his capacity with Boeing, Sam develops and executes strategies to cultivate a competitive, diverse, and adaptive workforce. Prior to joining Boeing, Sam was president and CEO of Thrive Washington, an early learning public-private partnership focused upon delivering a comprehensive, high-quality early learning environment for every child and family in Washington State. From 2007 to 2014, Sam was responsible for employee engagement and public policy efforts related to education for Boeing in the Northwest region. He's also served as director of foundation projects for Seattle Foundation, where he directed early childhood and literacy programs at Children's Home Society of Washington, and Page Ahead, a statewide children's literacy nonprofit. Sam's also a member of the Ready Nation, the organization of nearly 2,000 business executives building a skilled workforce by promoting solutions that prepare children to succeed in education, work, and life. Both Mission Readiness and Ready Nation are part of the Council for a Strong America, a co-sponsor of today's webinar. A few housekeeping items before we begin. If you're tweeting about today's webinar, please use the hashtag #DeeperLearning that you see in the bottom of your screen. You can also use that hashtag to ask any questions of our panelists, or you can use the question box below this video window. Finally, we're recording today's webinar, and we'll make archived video and PowerPoint slides available for on-demand viewing. So General Hall used to fly airplanes. Sam's company builds airplanes. I confirmed with Maria before the webinar, she has been on an airplane before, as have I. But that's not why we're here today. Today, our focus is on preparing students for 21st century jobs and careers. We'll also talk about the role that external partners, including business, higher education, and community organizations, can play in helping students supplement the learning that takes place in schools to better prepare them for college and the workforce. Now, at the beginning of the so-called Great Recession in December 2007, we saw dramatic shifts in the nation's workforce. Unemployment rates skyrocketed from roughly 5% to over 10%. Individuals of all education levels were affected, but individuals with higher levels of education were less affected. Today, 10 years after this global crisis, many of the jobs that disappeared during the Great Recession have not come back. Instead, they've either been lost to overseas competition or replaced by technology and automation. According to the Georgetown Center on Education and the Workforce, over 95% of the jobs created during the recovery have gone to workers with at least some college education, while those with a high school diploma or less are being left behind. Those numbers are reflected in unemployment rates, which are now much lower, but individuals with higher levels of education continue to fare better. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the unemployment rate in July 2017 for high school dropouts was 6.9%, compared to 4.5% for high school graduates and only 2.4% for individuals with a college degree or higher. Even when employed, high school dropouts earn about $8,000 a year less than high school graduates and approximately $26,500 a year less than college graduates, based on a 2011 study by the Alliance for Excellent Education. So how can we prepare students for the jobs of tomorrow? New York Times columnist and Pulitzer Prize-winning author Todd Freeman had said, quote, "If you're training people for a job that's already been invented, or if you're going to school in preparation for a job that's already been invented, you're going to have problems somewhere down the road," end quote. I interpret Freeman's comment to mean that rather than preparing students for a particular job, you've got to make sure that students have the skills and competencies they need to adapt to a changing job market. One way to do that is through deeper learning. Deeper learning is an educational approach that delivers challenging academic standards to students in innovative ways that allows them to learn and apply what they have learned. It includes the ability to understand content deeply, to use that knowledge to think critically and solve problems, to communicate effectively in a variety of media, to collaborate with others, and to be a lifelong learner through the ability to direct one's own learning. There are a variety of instructional approaches that can result in deeper learning outcomes, including personalized learning, work-based learning, project-based learning, and others. Although these instructional approaches engage students in different ways, all of them incorporate rigorous content grounded in state academic standards. Getting students to a place where they can develop deeper learning competencies requires a shift in instructional and learning practices. Educators must embrace a student-centered approach where they facilitate student learning, help students uncover knowledge, and design their own learning through real-world situations and give students agency in their own learning. It's an environment that is challenging and engaging and allows teachers to empower student agency, but also challenge students and support those who may struggle. So as the nation's labor market continues to grow and adapt to a changing world, so must the experiences students have in the nation's schools. So Maria, you've done quite a bit of research on why these deeper learning competencies are so important to ensuring that students graduate ready for college and careers. Can you take some time to tell our audience what you found in your research?
Absolutely. As Jason said, we were very interested in doing some research that focused on two very key areas in education right now, social and emotional learning and the development of skills and competencies, and also just overall college and career readiness for a changing world. So we set out to figure out a way to look at both labor market data and some of the research around some of these social and emotional competencies, which is not easy to do because from a research perspective, these are two very different worlds, and we can talk about how that plays out in policy a little later. Our report, Building Competencies for Careers, used the U.S. Department of Labor's ONET database for its labor market data. That's a database of over 900 jobs and occupations and the work styles, abilities, skills, and competencies that are required for those jobs. And we did an overlay with the six deeper learning competencies that Jason had mentioned earlier. We basically created a research link between the two. On this slide, we'll give you a little bit of a sense, a conceptual map of the project. As you can see on the left are the six deeper learning competencies, and on the right are the different categories that the jobs and occupations within ONET are categorized. They have jobs categorized in both Bright Outlook and non-Bright Outlook categories. Bright Outlook are those jobs that are expected to grow over time and have more opportunities. And non-Bright Outlook are jobs that are not, it's not that they're not projected to grow or to die off, they're just projected to hold steady. ONET also breaks their jobs down into five zones. Job Zone 1 would be the one that had the least requirements needed. Job Zone 5 would be the most. So we created a research link between these two, and I'm going to just share with you briefly some of the findings, and that'll inform our discussion as we move on. So one of the most interesting points that we can mention straight off is that for both Bright Outlook jobs and non-Bright Outlook jobs, all of them required at least one deeper learning competency, and for lots of jobs and occupations, they required multiple competencies. The ones that showed most, if you will, are developing academic mindsets, learning how to learn, and communicate effectively. These three, across both categories, were really dominant. Developing academic mindsets touches on research that has been done by a number of people, Carol Dweck, Angela Duckworth, and others. Learning how to learn and communicate effectively really speaks to that timelessness that Thomas Friedman was mentioning, that when Jason referred to that Thomas Friedman quote. And again here, when you look at the data across all five job zones, you see again that the deeper learning competencies have relevance across all five zones. It really isn't just a case of in the most complicated job that requires the most requirements that these skills and competencies are important. All across the zones, they are important. And again, those big three, developing academic mindset, learning how to learn, and communicating effectively. Of course, the others are very important too. And don't be confused by down on the bottom there where you see master core academic content as not being very important at all. The reason for that is in these jobs, they're speaking more to the skills and competencies, not the actual content knowledge. The people who make up the ONED database are presuming that there is a level of academic knowledge for those jobs. So it's very important to remember that this data doesn't represent an either or of developing an academic mindset is most important and is not at all important to master academic content. That would not be the way to read this. And of course, the report goes into far more detail. And for you research nerds out there, like myself, there's a very ample appendix that explains the methodology. So if you have questions about that, you can sort of dig in and see how this was done. Finally, I guess I would just say that it really speaks to the fact that these skills and competencies are just important across all jobs and occupations. There's really not one place where they belong. They have a presence amongst all the job zones, and I think we'll probably have that point elucidated in your comments later. So I'll pass it on back to you.
Great, thanks. It's just really great research and great information.
Thank you.
General Hall, I want to get to you. CEP's report talks about how labor market research and education research represent kind of two very different and distinct worlds, and how the professional world still tends to think of skills and competencies as soft or emotional. I'd love to know what your experience is in trying to find the right balance between what the labor market or the military tells us about what they tell us and kind of how schools prepare students.
Well, first of all, I think that the military is the broad social and educational integrator across the entire country. And as such, it's looking for young men and women who embody the deeper learning skills that were just outlined. That skill set has not been readily available nationwide. And so the military and some of the larger employers, Boeing likely among them, have developed very extensive internal training and education programs in order to take the raw material or raw recruits that they're able to assess and convey to them the proper knowledge and capability to do a full range of jobs. And if you look across the military skill sets, it mirrors society. We have everything from cooks to jet engine mechanics to intelligence people to IT folks. So there's really a greater gap than we would like to see. And that gap is filled in the Air Force by Air Education and Training Command, in the Army by TRADOC, with very, very extensive internal education programs that are essentially post-high school graduate programs.
That's great. What were kind of your opinion overall about Maria's report or CEP's report?
Oh, I think it's terrific. You know, we've been beating the drum on this one for a long time because the deeper learning competencies are really about developing a process capability for life. It's a journey, not a destination, to use that cliche. And young people who emerge from public education and some private education with those deeper learning competencies are much better able to adapt over time to the inevitable changes we see in society. And particularly now, in recent decades, the rate of change as technology has become so deeply embedded in practically everything we do is just accelerated. And if you're not ready to get on board, you're going to get left behind. And when you're left behind, you become part of those statistics that we're trying to address. You're unemployed, you're disenfranchised, you're discouraged, and we don't want our young people to be there. We want to give them the competencies that they need to succeed. And this is great. You know, I always move from what I think to what I know to what I can prove. And the report really moves us down that road. Intuitively, a lot of us have thought that when hands and minds separated in the educational system more century or more ago, that that was a course correction was needed to bring it back together. And this sort of research just really hangs the clothes on that clothes tree and says, yep, that's right, it does matter. Now we can trace cause and effect through the education system. And hopefully that'll help us in the national discussion about how to go about educating people.
Sam, General Hall made the point about change in society, rapid change mm-hmm. in society. I'd love for you to talk about what changes you've seen in the overall readiness of young people as they begin their careers. You know, some examples of things that maybe have changed or mm-hmm. haven't changed in your experience.
Sure. So I guess, first of all, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Thanks for the report, for good reading. I would start maybe by saying, you know, if you just take the aviation industry by itself as part of a larger advanced manufacturing technology sector, you know, 101 years ago when Boeing started, all you had to have was willingness. All you had to have was like, let's go, I'll learn everything, let's do it, we'll figure it out together. And that worked okay in the beginning. And then at some point we had to get to looking for people who actually had the knowledge that they could bring to the jobs to enrich the work that was happening there and the ways in which we could innovate in aviation. And so the knowledge was great, and we really focused on how do we help four-year colleges build degree programs and engineering and all of that kind of stuff. Then at some point, relatively recently, I would say in the last couple decades, we got to a place where we really thought about aptitude, that it wasn't, you weren't going to walk in, you know, in an industry where people work for decades in the same company, maybe not in the same job. You know, you want people who are able to come in and learn. They know how to learn, part of what Maria was talking about. And I think more recently, we have really gotten to a place of thinking about attitude, which is to me the other part of this report, that it is both the capacity to be a lifelong learner and the desire to be a lifelong learner. Those, I think, are different things. And I think, you know, you think about Ray Conner, who is the president and CEO of Boeing Commercial Airplanes, which is one of the companies that makes up the Boeing company, who started 41 years ago on the factory floor, went, you know, got out of high school, went to Alaska on a fishing boat, didn't like it, came back and, you know, got a job at Boeing, like with no experience or training, and was trained in, you know, on site to do what he needed to do, and now is, you know, in this position and is, you know, retiring in a few months, and we'll miss him a lot. But he has been a zealot about our work in education around making this kind of transformation because of what he has seen himself. And frankly, like, you don't walk onto the factory floor from a fishing boat anymore. You know, we don't have those kinds of openings now for folks. People do need to come in with more of the knowledge and the aptitude and the attitude to be able to do the job. The other thing, the other example I would give, aside from just the personal example of Ray, is you know, mechatronics is a field that we couldn't hire people 10 years ago with a degree in mechatronics because they didn't exist. And so all in advanced manufacturing, everyone who was working in robotics and doing the work that we now think of as mechatronics in a four-year degree program, they were all homegrown. And when companies like Boeing realized, wow, those people are all starting to get to retirement age, we need to be ready for what's going to happen next, we realized that we needed to take a two-pronged approach to that. One, to keep growing those folks internally with that expertise, but also to look externally and see how we could create the kinds of programs in two-year colleges and four-year colleges that would lead people to have those kinds of skills that would they'd be able to come in and not just, you know, hit the ground running, but also help enrich the work that we're doing in those fields.
Let me dig just a little bit deeper on what you were just saying there. Can you talk a little bit about what Boeing is doing now to kind of fill that gap that you were talking about?
Yeah, so there are a lot of people at Boeing who work on education issues. I jokingly say all the time that I work with about 150 or so thousand education experts. Even though I'm the, you know, education strategy lead. So it's a lot of what we do is try to think about what are our direct talent pipeline needs, and how are we, through our human resources group, working on those? You know, we need folks from with these degrees from these universities to come to work at Boeing, or from these anywhere from a 12-week certificate program, frankly, to a four-year college or beyond that. So that's all happening, which is all about what, and it's, we are not unique in this way. Corporations do really have to think about their own hiring needs. At the same time, we as a company recognize that if the talent pipeline for aerospace and advanced manufacturing is robust, that will benefit the entire industry. And we have, you know, tens of thousands of suppliers all over the country. And our ability to make sure that they are able to find the folks that they need helps them be able to work in good partnership with us. So that broadens it to us thinking about, from more of a community engagement kind of way, how are we both working with educational institutions and community-based organizations to enrich kids' employment or education experience, as well as to think about the ways in which we can take things that we used to do really very internally, where you would come to Boeing and then you would get trained, and externalize those so that they are beneficial not just to our employees but to others as well. And, you know, we have gotten to the point now where we really think of the talent pipeline as, you know, starting in early learning. We want to be sure that kids are ready in math when they enter kindergarten, because that's a big predictor of their long-term academic success. We want to make sure that they're engaged and excited about STEM subjects and about exploration that they might learn through environmental or arts education. We want to be sure that they have the kind of career connections early enough that they are getting, they're graduating from high school with a diploma that will actually get them a job or into a, anything from a 12-week certificate to a four-year degree. And then once they're out of the high school, we want to be sure that we're supporting a robust workforce development pipeline so that folks who are not getting the opportunity right away have the opportunity to come back into those kinds of programs and find a living wage job in a high demand sector, whether it's aerospace or healthcare or any number of things.
General, let me go to you. What have you seen in terms of best practices to help promote and ensure readiness and competency when it comes to education in the workforce?
Well, I always like to go back to High Tech High in San Diego, and that's something that our audience can Google and learn a great deal about. Seeing that institution was very formative to me. First of all, because when I went there, it became obvious that the students were treated as customers. And there was a real effort to produce a product that met the customer's needs and requirements. And they did that by providing every student with an individual education program. That's just like meeting your customer specifications, if you will. The students there all worked together in a common academic environment, and they worked collaboratively. And there were cute little things like, for example, one computer for every two students to foster the need for collaboration and communication to get the job done. And the last thing was every student at High Tech High has a work experience. So they understand that they're going to school for a purpose, and that is to acquire skills that will allow them to have a meaningful life where they can earn a wage and all the things that go with that. Now, what's really great about High Tech High is you get in there with a zip code lottery. It's not who writes the best essay. It's not who scores the highest on the test. It's who applies and is picked out of a hat, so to speak. And you might think across a diverse metropolitan area like San Diego, but that would be a real recipe for challenge and maybe failure. But in fact, essentially every student graduates and goes on to higher education or to further job training after High Tech High. So the formula that's in place out there, I think, is a leading example of how education at a great scale in a metropolitan area or in a small rural community can organize, focus on students, and focus on those deep learning criteria that we talked about, and in the process make young lives or give young lives the basis for success. Listening to Sam, one of the biggest things that occurs to me is that especially in the public school system, when the starting gun goes off at first grade, you either keep up or you or you're lost. And the reason that pre-K education is so important is to help prepare young people for this huge change that takes place when suddenly they're marching K through 12. But if you miss step anywhere along the way, it's a horrible experience for your self-esteem, for your potential after you're done with your education. And for that reason, I think we need to do all the things that are spoken to in the report and that have been discussed, because Boeing can't help you if you don't show up at Boeing with the basics. You know, if you don't know how to block and tackle, you can't learn their playbook, to use a football analogy. And so that's why I think that this report and the work you're doing is so important, because it adds to the conversation, it adds to the argument about how we need to organize to effectively educate young people in our country.
Sam, I want to get back to a point you made earlier, and Maria, I'd love to get your thoughts as well. Mm-hmm. You know, you were talking about kind of the divide between higher ed and business, and you talked a little bit about Boeing and working with the higher education mm-hmm. community. You know, what you've seen in your experience, what can businesses do to ensure that students, when they come out, are better aligned, you know, either at the high school level or college with some of the openings that you have as a mm-hmm. as a business?
I think the more that we as a business can be involved in the education community around program development, so that it's not, you know, I think about the two-year college system, which for a while was a little bit about, we need welders, and then the two-year colleges would produce a lot of welders. And I think the kind of partnerships that have emerged more recently are a much more effective way for higher ed to be engaged in workforce needs in a more flexible, adaptable way. Mm-hmm. To think about, you know, what are the, we have actually, our manufacturing workforce folks at Boeing have worked very hard with two-year college systems around not just we need, you know, aero mechanic who has these set of skills, to like those skills are applicable not just in aerospace but also in construction and in maritime and in auto, and how can we help them create a program that can be applicable, can produce graduates that are able to be a part of all of those industries. We actually have worked, for instance, in Washington State with the state superintendent's office to create a program called Core Plus, which started out as, it actually started out as externalized Boeing training, and has developed into a two-year program where the first year of it is manufacturing basics, and the second year, right now there is an aerospace thread for the second year, and they are working, the state is working with the maritime industry and the construction industry to build those threads as well, so that a student could attend, you know, English or other classes half the day, be in this advanced manufacturing program the other half of the day, and end up not just with a high school diploma, but also with certificates that will let them walk into manufacturing jobs. And the longer we have been in it, the more we have worked with the state to say, okay, what the kids are learning in this part of this curriculum could meet their math and science requirements for this part of, you know, what's required for next generation science standards or for Common Core, that sort of thing.
That's great.
Yeah, I just wanted to pick up on something both of you have said, and that's that interplay between attitude and opportunity, and that you really need both, whereas you can give students opportunities to develop these skills and competencies, but it's really important for them to have the internal attitude to make the most of them. And the deeper learning competencies really speak to this, because when you think about, you know, developing an academic mindset and learning how to learn, you know, these are things that tend to be internally focused, as an individual needs to sort of develop in themselves. And then the collaboration and the communication is really external. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something that they're engaging in with their fellow students, and then eventually professionally their colleagues. And I think in the past, and you alluded to this with the great story about the Boeing guy working on the fishing boat and just mm-hmm. walking into the factory, how these things never happen anymore. I do think that life has changed for young people. Maybe they had more opportunities, or maybe we did in the past, to develop skills and competencies, not just in school, but also in our normal life, our social life and our civic life. Well, all of those things have also changed, right along with how industry has changed. So I think it might be a little bit more challenging for students sometimes to develop these skills and competencies, and maybe just solely relying on school systems to do that is not the way to go, and you both have said this. You know, industries need to be part of it, communities need to be part of it, parents need to be part of it, the social and civic infrastructure of places where kids live. Everyone has a role, I think, to play in helping students develop these skills and competencies and experience them, and obviously you two are doing your part, yay you. But I do think it is a sense of time, too, that times have changed, and what was once a little bit easier for students to do is now a little bit more challenging. I just think that's sort of an interesting overlay to all of this.
Yeah, that's a great point, Maria. And you talked about, you know, kind of the role of external partners in ensuring that kids are college and career ready. And General Hall, I want to get to you and also get some questions from our viewers as they come in. This one comes from David in Maryland, who asks, what's the best evidence you've seen that initiating workforce skills development at middle or early high school pays dividends to youth and puts them on a realistic pathway to true middle school middle skill jobs and preparing for college and career? General, I think you've seen this a lot firsthand with your experience with Wings of Eagles, and I'd love just to take a minute to hear your experience there and what you've seen.
We have. Wings of Eagles Discovery Center is a science academy in Elmira, New York, a challenged community where a third of the young people don't graduate from high school. And we felt that we had a role as an informal science organization to partner with the school districts to provide a different perspective and a more comprehensive opportunity for young people to acquire deeper learning skills. And we just had 760 go through our academies this summer. What we've seen is that when you take them from the lecture room, if you will, and put them out on the hangar floor with a robotic device that they have to figure out, assemble, and operate, there's a real hook there. It's putting hands and minds together. It's forcing them to work together to do something that many of these young people, because of their socioeconomic background, never dreamed that they'd have an opportunity to do something like that. And so it's very exciting and encouraging to them. And I think that's part of building an attitude that that will carry over into the deeper learning mindset that we need them to develop.
That's great. I want to shift a little bit. We've talked a lot about the business side of the equation and how to get, you know, businesses, higher ed involved. We got a question from Susan in Texas, and she's focused on the family side of this relationship. She wants to know how you can educate students and families on careers that they may never have experienced. You know, we talked about how quickly the job market can change and jobs come forth in a very short amount of time that we never even knew about. You know, so many families are focused on ensuring that they send their kids to, you know, a sustainable career that a lot of times they may know is a very valid career for now. I'd love to hear from everyone if you have thoughts on how you can help students and families understand, you know, the importance of a career they may not know, or being able to adjust and have the skills to adapt to a changing workforce.
I'll start.
Please.
I think, you know, we really try, beginning in early learning, actually, to think about this idea of parent engagement and how we are helping, you know, in early math, for instance, helping parents understand the difference between pointing at a three-sided object and saying that's a triangle and pointing at a three-sided object and saying that's a triangle because it has three sides. And that kind of basic information is so important for parents to understand the role that they can play. And I think we can think about that in more content-driven or academic concepts. It's harder, we forget about that when we get, even I would say in elementary school, but certainly into middle school, about the role that parents can play expressing their own experience of their own careers or the careers of other people in the family and what they know about how folks got there. You know, I have this crazy, long, and winding road in my career to get where I have gotten today. And if you had asked me when I was half my age if I would have this job, I would have laughed in your face. And I am not kidding. But, you know, I love it, and I'm really good at it. And I think it's partly my passion around that was instilled in me by my parents and the examples that they set and the examples that they brought to me to be able to see what was possible. I think, you know, there are a lot of community-based organizations, whether they be, you know, out-of-school time programs or whether they be academic enrichment programs or that sort of thing, that really work hard to, you know, have career fairs or college fairs or that sort of thing from a pretty early age that helps parents understand the role that they can play and also helps parents understand what's out there. You know, we all live within our own experience, and so we don't always have a very big idea about what's possible for our kids beyond kind of the you know top 10 careers that probably every parent, if you're a lawyer or a doctor or you know whatever it is, an actuary, why not be an actuary, to think about all of the ways in which their children can have a very productive family life where they can you know support their family and really enjoy the work that they're doing and remain flexible in the ways in which that can happen.
General Hall, anything to add?
Well, to me, it all comes down to public displays of learning. Every course that we run at Wings of Eagles ends with an opportunity for families, caregivers, guardians, whoever is part of the circle of that young person's life, to come in and see what they've accomplished. And, you know, you're talking about kids who, over a five-day period, day one, we don't know why we're here. You know, somebody's rounded us up, put us on a bus, brought us out to this place outside the hood that we don't come out here. We're pretty uncomfortable. We're facing a challenge that we never thought about. At day two, they're beginning to get it. Day three, their robots are running around. End of the week, they are justifiably proud as punch to have whoever's important to them as the adults in their world come and see what they've accomplished. And that is mutually beneficial. First of all, for the young person, it's an affirmation. And it's always an affirmation because the adults, being older, are pretty damn amazed by what they're seeing. You know, it's like, maybe I could do this, you know? So I think public displays of learning is a very, very important part of the fabric of developing the deeper learning competencies.
I would just say, from my perspective, I'm fortunate enough to work on a college campus, so I'm surrounded by young people all the time, you know, who are obviously there and engaging in education and trying to think about their future. And I think, to your point, Sam, one of the things you want to impart on all kids is that, you know, your career in some ways is really a long and winding road, and manage your expectations because there are going to be bumps along the way and it may not all go the way you want it to go. And this is the lesson, I think, for both kids and parents. But if you have, you know, kind of these basic skills and competencies within yourself, you know, you can probably weather a lot. You may have to go back and get more training. You may have to go back and get more education at some point. You know, it's not like you do this K through 12 and then maybe for a time afterwards and then you never have to go back and think about what you know and what you don't know again. All of us do. So I think sometimes the narrative of how you prepare yourself for work and education is a little is poorly defined. I think it really needs to be something that you think about throughout your entire life, and that's okay. That's the way it is, and it's probably only going to get more so that way.
Yeah, Sam, I can empathize with what you were saying about your career path. I remember when I was in college, you know, I was an English major and government major. But when I told people I was an English major, you know, everyone said, "What are you going to do? Teach?" And I think that's a great profession, obviously, for you to teach. It wasn't something that I wanted to pursue, but being an English major taught me how to write and it taught me how to think. And if you can do those two things, you know, you have a pretty decent amount of opportunities out there. So I want to get to another question. Emily in New York asked about our most vulnerable students. Specifically, she's asking about students in the juvenile justice system, but I'm going to expand it just a little bit to include students from low-income families and students of color. These students make up more than half of all students in the nation's K-12 system, but they often face the greatest challenges, as many of us know. Their graduation rates lag behind their peers, sometimes by more than 20 percentage points in some states. They often attend some of our lowest performing schools. Their teachers are frequently new to the field. They lack access to resources and veteran teachers who can provide support and guidance. So I'd love to hear from our panel about how we can better prepare these students for the workforce. And General Hall, you mentioned earlier that a lot of the kids who come through your program come from some of these historically underserved communities, just facing a lot of challenges. And I'd just love to know, you know, what you've seen and how you kind of help those kids get opportunities that they may not get, you know, in a traditional school system.
Well, a lot of our students do come from challenging backgrounds, but I think that makes them quick learners. If you can put them in the right environment, you know, they're used to having to pay attention on a daily basis just to get by. And when you can put them in a safe environment and offer them challenges that allow them to develop their capabilities in and around skill sets that society values, that society will employ them to do and compensate them for their work, they respond very well. And I think one of the biggest things is confidence. A number of years ago, a young woman said to me that that was the most important attribute. And I hadn't really thought about it at the time, but, you know, she was right. If I go into a situation in school feeling poorly about myself, maybe malnourished that day because of the circumstances I came from, and I don't have any confidence, I'm set up to fail. And so what we try to do at Wings of Eagles is give them success and build on success. And when that happens, you have a much greater capacity to overcome those bumps that you spoke of in life, because we all have them. And, you know, they either take you out or you triumph over them. And giving young people a measure of success built around those deeper learning principles is a terrific way to empower them to success across the board in their life.
That's great. I want to get to another question from our audience. This one comes from Jen in Washington. She's talking about technology and access to jobs. How do you think mobility and secure, widely accessible Wi-Fi will impact the human capital available to businesses? How will businesses shift career opportunities to accommodate talent that cannot afford to live and work in the same area? And obviously, we're seeing a lot of this already. I'd love to know what thoughts any of you might have on what you've seen or what you expect to see just through technology, through Wi-Fi, through, you know, kind of jobs following talent.
You know, I think we have seen a lot in the computer sciences and the high tech in that thing. You know, Boeing, we think of ourselves as high tech, so we divide it up a little. But there is a lot of mobility, I think, in computer science work where you see a lot of companies that might be based one place, have offices in five places, but then have employees in 500 places. And I think that's been a huge boost to opportunity, particularly for populations that are historically underrepresented in high-tech fields. I think, you know, there's always the other side of that, which is the quote-unquote touch labor side of it. You know, a lot of advanced manufacturing actually has to occur someplace. And so it's been interesting to see in the aerospace industry or in other manufacturing industries how the same kinds of technologies can help teams collaborate. For instance, at Boeing, we have two innovation centers, one in Sheffield, England, and one that we're setting up in Portland, Oregon, that are part of the same group that will work together to help provide a skunk works for, which might be a term that I know and isn't a commonly used term, but where I come from, it's a commonly used term, a place where folks who are working on the factory floor can take a problem offline, try to figure out what it is, and how they can fix it very quickly and not disrupt the production line, and then come back and implement a solution. And the fact that we are able to do that not just in two different cities in the U.S., but actually on two different continents, is all the result of the kinds of technological advances that we've seen and the access to that technology that allows more and more young people to gain some exposure to and interest in working with those technologies over the course of their career.
I just think it's an example of the Skunk Works example, at least for me. I wrote down social emotional technology, as you were talking mm-hmm. about how the technology allows them to engage in multiple locations, mm-hmm. but the actual act of the engagement is still so much tied in the social and emotional mm-hmm. skills. So there's really this connection. The technology allows for so much, but it still doesn't change the fact that some of these things are really just basically about what's inside a person as well, and that I think the interplay between the two really does have to be thoughtful. Technology simply can't do everything. There are still people involved in all of that technology who need tending to and nurturing and all this kind of thing. So it's almost like in order to maximize both areas, you need to make sure that they are in lockstep together.
Right. I would even say that kind of technological solution amplifies the need for people
exactly.
who have the kinds of social emotional skills that will allow them to work well on teams and communicate effectively
right.
and all of those things.
And I'm sure that's true in the military as well, yeah?
Well, actually, my time in the military preceded a lot of this, but not my time in education. And one of the things we do is spend a lot of time talking about the balance between virtual and reality. Mm-hmm. And one of the great programs we have at Wings of Eagles involves importing a space mission from the Challenger Space Center in Wheeling, West Virginia. And we have our mission control room, and they have their mission control room. And the students, there are a number of scripted programs, but one, for example, Space Station Alpha, the astronauts on the space station are suddenly going to be subject to a large solar flare. And the students have to figure out, is that a problem, and what can we do about it? And the solution, which they don't know but almost inevitably come to, is to take all the water supplies on the space station and put them on the sun side of the structure to filter the radiation out before it gets to the astronauts. And they do this working from consoles, much like we're sitting here this afternoon looking at a screen. And on the other end of the screen is a mission director from a long ways away that's running the script for them. So they, we're going to try this. And so they try this, and after a few minutes, the mission director comes back and says, no, there was no change. You have to try something else. And the ability to do that adds an element of excitement, but preserves the collaboration communication skills at the local level. And getting that balance is a real challenge. I don't think we're even close yet. I think the potential of technology is way, way greater today than the actuality of what we're seeing in the classroom. And I hope that's an area that develops, as I'm sure it will, over the next few years.
I thought that you were giving away what they needed to do to solve the problem. Like, spoiler
maybe
alert.
They're not watching.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's phenomenal. It reminds me of, when I was a kid, they had these choose-your-own-adventure books, and you know, you've got a rocket that's exploding. What do you want to do? You do A or B, and you turn to page B, and it's like, oh, your rocket exploded. This sounds like a lot more kind of, you'd be a lot more engaged. I mean, just to have that, not only the technology involved, but someone being remote. I mean, and working together.
Right.
I think that's just a phenomenal experience.
So
for
we're
kids.
Building on that. We got a NASA grant, and we are building the first school on Mars. And the nice thing about building the first school on Mars is you don't have to pattern it after anything here on Earth. You just have to look at the circumstances of Mars, the environment that you live in up there, and you create your school and the subjects that you need to master in order to live on Mars. And this is kind of a variation of the theme of Spaceship Alpha, if you will. And we're going to have an actual facility that you go into, which makes you think you're on Mars. That's our goal. And then you're going to be presented with a whole variety of problems. And Mars is terrific because it's smaller than Earth, which means it cooled more quickly. So it's really an advanced aged Earth.
Yeah.
So you can look at Mars today and say, well, sometime in the future, this is what Earth is going to be like unless we do certain things. And very, very good environment to spark creativity and excitement on kids, because we're not in our own backyard. We're on Mars now. That's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. I want to go back to the point about Wi-Fi, and we got another question. This one comes from Lane in Nebraska. And he's essentially asking you about the challenge of rural schools, where you know you often you don't have the high-speed internet connections. You may not have a lot of businesses, you know, large-scale businesses who can come in and partner with you. I grew up in a very rural part of Virginia, and I remember I was part of this internship program as a college student, and they would connect you to a local business that was participating in the program. Where I lived, there weren't any businesses participating in the program, so I essentially didn't get to do anything that summer. I'd love to know, you know, what you're doing in rural schools or what you've seen is in terms of ensuring that kids in some more rural areas have access to some of these, you know, really rich learning environments.
Well, so I guess for us, there are two ways in which we would answer that question. When we think about our education work, one of the other things that we think is really important is that we're engaged in the education policy debate, mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's a very large public system, and the public system is really a lot of what will be able to help us equalize the opportunities that are available to students. It's not something where we have seen the kind of success that I think we would all like, but we have seen some pretty significant success over time in terms of the transformation of the public school system to be more adaptive and more focused on 21st century needs and skills and realities. So I think that's part of it. I think also the more that, for instance, in our case, I mentioned earlier that we have this supplier base of all of these thousands and thousands of companies that we work with, and they are all over the country, in every state. And we work as much with them through associations or through other organizations to engage them to help broaden the opportunity that's available so that they may be a company of 100 people, not 150-something thousand people, but if we can help provide lessons from what we have done and provide support to organizations that can reach out to them as well, it's a way in which we can try to help reach more communities where we don't have employees that want to go to a school. You know, we have trouble getting our employees to go to a school that's 45 minutes from a factory, much less halfway across a state. So we have, you know, we are always trying to be creative about our who we can partner with, who can have more of that kind of reach, because you know this everything we've talked about, including incarcerated youth or kids of color, it's all about the opportunity that needs to be available to them. That we, it's incumbent upon us as a society, as a civic being, to be able to provide to them so that they can have the same kind of opportunity.
I mean, well said. I think it's a unique challenge. I think rural communities, especially when it comes to the things that we've been talking about today, it is hard. I mean, technology can certainly be a friend and help things, the kind of connectivity that you were talking about in some rural communities where kids can take AP classes from a university that may be 100 miles away, but they can experience it virtually. I mean, these are all interesting innovations, but you know, the civic aspect of rural life can be so robust in some ways and then, you know, terribly needy in other ways. So it is a thorny issue, especially as we're facing more, you know, more complex global economy. How do you really give these kids the kind of access they need so they don't have to leave, you know? That's the other piece. But I do think that the best solutions are ones that are made with a tremendous amount of input from the local community. It's not something that communities need done to them. They need to be participating in it.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. That is one of the really tremendous advantages that rural communities bring forward. It's the relationships.
Yeah.
Because they're typically so small, you know, the teacher knows the family because they, you know, it's a small town. They know the brother,
the
they know the sister.
The bus driver.
Yeah, the principal's the bus driver. So I think it is an opportunity to build a lot of these relationships that we talk about that are so important between students mm-hmm. and teachers. So there definitely are advantages to rural areas. Obviously, challenges as well. Mm-hmm. Technology can play a role in helping to alleviate some of that, but you know, sometimes the connectivity just isn't there. So I think, you know, it's a continuing challenge, as yep. as you say. So we're running low on time. In a minute, I want to go to our panel and get any closing thoughts that they might have. But before we go, I did want to highlight a couple of new resources for our audience. First is a new website at deeperlearning4all.org that you see at the bottom of your screen. It contains action steps that business leaders, higher education, community members, K-12 educators, a lot of people and external audiences we've talked about today, that they can take in their schools and communities to implement deeper learning and better prepare students for college and career. Again, the website's at the bottom of your screen, deeperlearningforall.org. Second, the Alliance for Excellent Education today released a series of toolkits that offer support and guidance to state education leaders and school district leaders as they consider whether to implement or expand a deeper learning initiative in their schools and districts. There are several components to these toolkits. First is an overview that provides kind of a basic content and other information on deeper learning. It includes a section on equity that explains the moral and economic imperatives of ensuring that all students have access to deeper learning, especially students from low-income families, students of color, and a lot of the other students from traditionally underserved communities that we talked about. Second is a section on assessing deeper learning that describes the different approaches to using and communicating student assessment data that focuses on deeper learning outcomes. And the last section is focused specifically on deeper learning in high schools. It includes information on policies, procedures, and practices, but also how school district leaders could use time, can use school space, can use digital literacy and technology to enhance deeper learning. The toolkit's available at alfred.org/deeper-learning-toolkits that you see at the bottom of your screen. And you know, before we close, I want to just give our panel a chance to make any parting comments for our audience, if you will.
I'll encourage people to go to the CEP website, www.cep-dc.org, so they can access this report. We have additional resources as well. Everything is free, and you can look through this research and others. It's great that we have folks from the education space here and the business community here, and I would argue that other aspects of our civic society need to be involved in this discussion as well. It's an important one, and this is a great first step, so thank you.
I would say to everyone that our discussion this afternoon is extremely important. You might wonder why 600 retired generals and admirals, as part of mission readiness, hold education as their number one national security threat. And the answer is simple. We are just not doing a good enough job educating our young people today, over two-thirds of whom are not qualified to serve in the military. And if you're not qualified to serve in the military, what else aren't you qualified to do in society? I can't fix it. This panel can't fix it. All of us together can begin to make a difference. And I would just end by reminding you of the starfish story, the old man and the young man walking down the beach, and the sun's coming up, and there's starfish all over the beach, and the young man reaches down, picks one up, and throws it back in the ocean. The old man says to him, "What's the point? There's so many starfish out here, and the sun's coming up. How can you possibly make a difference?" And the young person said, "Made a difference for that one." And that's what we have to do. Each of us has to pick up the yoke here and work to improve education in our country, or our country will not be what it is in the future.
Yes, I would add to that. I think the more that we can recognize the importance of research like this in defining what we're talking about, the more effective we can be in making change. I think we talk a lot about 21st century skills or deeper learning or knowledge, skills, and ability. Like we, you know, all of the ways in which we want students to be prepared beyond core academic content. And then we turn to the education community and say, okay, do that now. And it's really important that we stay engaged, all of us together, as you all have been saying, so that we share common understanding and we share common purpose in how we can move forward to make sure that our deepening knowledge about what's important in the workplace can inform our deepening knowledge about what's important in an educational environment and can help all of us together move in the same direction.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you all today for being here and for participating in such a very vibrant conversation. So again, thanks to our panel for joining us. I also want to thank you, our audience, for joining us. You had a lot of questions that came in today. I tried to work them into our conversation, and I hope that we were able to address a lot of those. If you missed any part of today's webinar or you want to watch it again, You can watch that at allfored.org/webinars. We'll have the video up by tomorrow morning, as well as Maria's PowerPoint slides. So thank you for watching. Have a great day.